Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, Courthouse Steps Decision, Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Beru. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Daniel Blomberg, a senior counsel for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Daniel, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. So as was just said, my name is Daniel Blomberg. I'm a senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. And Beckett is counsel to the two schools in today's cases, Our Lady of Guadalupe School and St. James School. And the opinion is just handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. My firm, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, was also counsel in the previous ministerial exception case to reach the U.S. Supreme Court, the Hosanna-Tabor decision. So today's two decisions, the combined decisions in Our Lady and St. James, are very important decisions and very helpful in further establishing what the unanimous court did 8 years ago in Hosanna-Tabor. So what I'm going to do over the next half hour or so, I'm going to give a very brief overview of some of the takeaways of today's decision. Then I'm going to walk through a bit of history regarding the doctrinal issue that the court decided under the First Amendment today, which is a doctrine known as the ministerial exception. Then I'm going to walk through the case that the court decided today, give you some background on that, and talk about the court's ruling, including what made it distinct from the Hosanna-Tabor case, why the court was why it took it and why it was resolving it. And then I'm going to discuss a couple of key takeaways from the decision on what it does to further establish and solidify the First Amendment's protections for religious groups. So first, a brief overview, the takeaways from today's decision. The doctrine that's at issue is the First Amendment's religion clauses, protection for the internal autonomy of a religious group and their ability to select their leaders and their teachers and people who embody and express the faith within the context of the religious group. And so today's decision regarded two teachers that had sued their schools, their Catholic schools, over the school's decision not to renew their contracts. And the court, by a 7-2 margin, ruled in favor of the schools and found that the First Amendment protected the school's decision about selecting who to serve in a teaching capacity at the schools. So this is a huge win for all faith groups. The defendants here were Catholic schools, but as the court recognized today, there's a rich diversity of religious education in this country, and it specifically identified the many different faith traditions, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Adventists, Mormons, and others that have a strong emphasis on religious education and training up the next generation. And so the protections that the court recognized today apply to all of those faith groups in really profound ways. It's also a very important decision because it protects from government entanglement in core religious decisions. So one way to think of this is a very healthy separation of church and state in a case that really goes to the heartland of what the religion clauses working together are trying to do. The other thing that's really important coming out of today's decision is that it shows us that the form of the doctrine follows the function of the doctrine. That is, what really matters, what the courts really are trying to get at, is protecting the ability of religious groups to perpetuate their existence, to perpetuate their message and what they're trying to speak to their members and to people who choose to be a part of their associations. And so it's not so much about titles and other formalistic considerations as it is about what exactly is being done. It protects that core expression of religious belief and identity. And the final point that's really important is that this is a 7-2 win. That is, you have seven justices in the majority saying that the schools should win in this context. And that really speaks to the breadth of support for religious liberty in our society. And in fact, while it's a 7-2 decision on the core dispute that came before the court, it's actually a 9-0 decision when it comes to issues like Hosanna Tabor. All nine justices agree that the Hosanna Tabor case was rightly decided. Now, two of the justices have some disagreement about what Hosanna Tabor means, but all of them affirm it as strong precedent, just as they did eight years ago when Hosanna Tabor was decided. Next, all nine justices agree that while they disagree on this particular case, you know, two of them disagree with seven of them on this particular case, agree that the ministerial exception covers termination for religious reasons. So if a religious group decides to hire or fire someone for a religious reason, then that someone holds an important religious role within the ministry, then all the justices would agree that situation should be covered by the ministerial exception. So one of the big takeaways is that this case is marked by wide agreement on some of the very fundamental issues. Okay, so that's a brief overview of what we got out of the Our Lady decision today. Let me step back a little bit, step back a lot, and talk about how we got here, where we're coming from. And you have to go way back in history. You have to go back to Magna Carta when you're talking about the ministerial exception, because it really is rooted deeply in our traditions, and both ones that we things that we wanted to keep as a society, things we wanted to protect, and things that we were trying to try to avoid. So for instance, before the time of the founding, there were requirements in law in Britain that individuals could face lifetime imprisonment. Ministers could face lifetime imprisonment for preaching anything but what was in the official prayer book, the Book of Common Prayer. I don't remember what the first and second violations were, but the third violation, if you were teaching something as a minister other than what was in the Book of Common Prayer, you could face lifetime imprisonment. And you were forbidden to say anything, and I quote, this is in the decision today, say anything in plays, songs, rhymes, or by other open words that would be in violation of the Book of Common Prayer. So you had very strong state control of religious belief and religious expression. And that really kind of followed us across the pond as our nation was getting started. And Professor Michael McConnell noted that in early colonial Virginia, ministers were politically appointed by the crown. And the religious faithful that were a part of those congregations often were less than excited about that because, as you might imagine, politically appointed ministers were less than zealous in their spiritual responsibilities and less than irreproachable in their personal morals. That's a quote from Professor McConnell's seminal work on establishment and disestablishment of the founding. So there was a lot of control both over religious beliefs and over the ministers that were responsible for expressing those beliefs. And at the time of the founding, when we were put together and ratified the First Amendment, we wanted to get away from all that. We wanted to put the power to select ministers and express religious belief in the hands of religious congregations and not in the hands of politicians. And so we have the First Amendment's religion clauses. And it, both sides, there's been some cases that have said, there's a little bit of tension between what the Establishment Clause is trying to do and what the Free Exercise Clause is trying to do, and they kind of bump up each other against each other sometimes. But that's not the case here. Because here, when it comes to selecting the ministers who express the faith, the Free Exercise Clause says, well, religious groups have to be free to select those individuals, and because that's how they, identify and form themselves around common beliefs and select somebody who can express those beliefs. So they have the Free Exercise Clause protects the right of a religious group to select their ministers. And then on the other side, the Establishment Clause bars the government from getting involved in that decision. So both sides of this are working together. On one side, the Free Exercise protects that ability to make the choice. On the other side, the Establishment Clause says the government has to stay out of it. So that was what the establishment and free exercise clause, a big part of what they were meant to do. It was really kind of a heartland function, was protecting this ability of religious groups to be able to make their own decisions on the people who really kind of express their faith and lead their faith. Courts didn't have a lot of occasion to start applying this in the kind of situation that we saw today, where you have an employment non-discrimination lawsuit that's filed, where someone says, hey, you discriminated against me on some, illegal ground, and then you get the opportunity that goes to court, and people, both sides fight about whether or not that actually occurred. In the mid-1900s, when with the advent of federal employment discrimination laws, issues arose where you had individuals who were leading congregations, ministers, pastors, priests, and others, suing their churches under these laws. And so since 1972, courts have recognized fairly uniformly, every federal court of appeals have considered it, recognized that there's the First Amendment's twin values of free exercise and establishment required a ministerial exception, required an exception to the employment discrimination laws, and required avoiding interference in that employment relationship between a minister and that minister's ministry, so the church, between the church and the pastor, or church and the priest, or something like that. And so for several decades, over 30 years, the lower courts all uniformly recognized the existence of this ministerial exception and applied it fairly uniformly to these different types of cases. Well, in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court had its first opportunity to review one of these cases, in the Hosanna-Tabor Evangelical Church and School versus EEOC case. And there, you had all nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court agree that there was a ministerial exception, and it did apply to the particular plaintiff in that case, an individual who taught at a Lutheran school and who had certain considerations to their, there are certain considerations regarding their job that led the court to conclude that this person was a minister and thus fit within the ministerial exception and couldn't sue her own ministry to punish them for their employment decision. So that's kind of there were four considerations that the court looked at in that case, in the Hosanna-Tabor case. One was that the minister there had a formal title. She was called a minister. And two, she had pretty significant formal training that prepared her for religious vocation. And three, she had a religious tax status. She had claimed the housing exemption on her tax status. And then finally, she engaged in important religious functions. And so the court said, looking at all those considerations, it's very clear that she is a minister. And so we don't have to decide, if you need all four of those, if you need something less than that. It's clear that those four together mean that she's a minister and she can't sue the school over its decision to terminate her. So, and you had two important concurrences in that case, one by Justice Thomas, who said, we should go further and we should make it clear that you can't second guess a religious group's sincere determination of who is a minister, because otherwise you're going to get involved in internal religious questions and you have courts deciding these sort of issues. And then two, you had a concurrence by Justices Alito and Kagan saying that, the way you determine who a minister is primarily looking at the kinds of functions they perform. So yeah, you've got the four considerations, the title, the training, the tax status, and the function. But Justice Alito and Kagan said, that generally speaking, there's a functional consensus among the lower courts that the way you determine who is a minister is by looking at what they do. And the other things kind of confirm that, but they're not necessary to it. And in fact, it'd be significant problems if you made any of them necessary. If you made title, for instance, necessary, because then you would start imposing religious criteria on religious groups. So the courts would be saying, well, if this individual isn't titled a minister, or they don't have a specific kind of religious term by their name, then they can't be a minister. And so that would be kind of imposing a religious test by the federal courts and be a very significant establishment clause problem and free exercise problem. So while the title can confirm it, it can't be necessary to it, was what Justices Alito and Kagan were saying. So that's kind of the background for these particular cases that were decided by the U.S. Supreme Court today. And in the 8 years since the Hosanna-Tabor decision, a number of courts across the country in the 2nd, 3rd, 5th, 6th, 7th circuits had all followed Hosanna-Tabor, applied it to, you know, varying types of ministerial exception cases, and basically come out to a result that was very similar to what you saw Justices Alito and Kagan identifying. So they said, you know, there are those four considerations, but none of them, none of the courts had said you have to have all four. You need to show at least one of them. You need to show at least function, and then maybe one or two other ones. And so you had a couple of cases came down that were based on function plus title, and you had a couple that were based on function plus training. But you didn't have any that said you need all four. You got to have all four considerations to show that somebody really is a minister. And you also didn't, interestingly enough, you didn't have any that said you got to have title and tax status are enough by themselves. That case just hadn't come up, but it just, you know, no courts had said anything like that. And then in walks the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit decides in the two cases that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Our Lady case and the St. James case, that you do need all four, that those four were really kind of a rigid checklist, that you gotta show that they do have a title, they do have the training, they do have the tax status, and they have the function. And so in these particular cases, these were very similar to the Hosanna-Tabor case, in that you had a grade school teacher who taught several subjects, and one of those subjects was the faith of the particular school. In Hosanna-Tabor, it was a Lutheran school, and in these two cases, they were both Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. And the religious teaching function was very similar as well. In fact, it was, if anything, there was more religious function for both teachers in the cases, in the Our Lady and St. James cases, where these teachers were teaching the faith in really very significant ways, 200 minutes a week. You had more religious instructional content taking place in from these teachers than the students, you know, that they taught would receive from their parish priest. So on a weekly basis, they were getting more religious training from these teachers than they would from the parish priest. And the kinds of things they were learning were significant religious doctrine. So under the curriculum, for instance, in the Our Lady case, the teacher there was expected to teach the students to learn and express the belief that Jesus is the Son of God and the Word made flesh, and that they were supposed to learn how to identify the ways the church carries on the mission of Jesus, and to locate and read and understand stories from the Bible, and to know the names, meaning, signs, and symbols of each of the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church, and that they also need to be able to explain doctrinal concepts such as the communion of the saints. So they had, you know, significant religious responsibilities. They did a lot of other things too, like they would pray with their students several times a day, and they would take their students to Mass. And in the Our Lady case, they would also, you know, the teacher there would direct and produce an annual passion play. They tested their students in their religious training to make sure they understood it. So they had, you know, and they trained them in things like learning how to recite the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and helping them, you know, she'd help them learn how to celebrate the sacraments. So it was a very, you know, very significant religious responsibilities that were being taught every day of the week to these students. And that's why that's why the parents sent them there. These were Catholic schools, and they were very clear that the mission of the school was to inculcate the Catholic faith into the students that came. But one thing that was different, or three things actually that were kind of different in this case, as opposed to the Hosanna-Tabor case, is the teachers didn't have the title minister. they had the title teacher, and the teachers didn't have the kind of training that the teacher in the Hosanna Tabor case did. You know, they didn't have years of seminary type training to prepare them for the educational roles that they had here. And they also didn't have the tax status that the teacher in the Hosanna Tabor case did either. They didn't apply for or receive the housing allowance. So there was, you know, three of the considerations that were at issue in the Hosanna Tabor case arguably weren't at issue here. And so what you really had was a case that presented the kind of situation that Justices Alito and Kagan were talking about, at least at a certain level, and one way of looking at it. There are other things to consider that show that, yeah, they actually did have, you know, religious titles in certain respects and in certain ways and things like that. But the clearest comparator between the two sets of cases, the Hosanna Tabor cases and the ones that the Supreme Court decided today, were the religious functions, the very important and very significant religious functions that these teachers were performing. And the Ninth Circuit said that just wasn't enough, that they needed to be able to show those other types of considerations, and that because they didn't show those other considerations, the religious stuff here wasn't sufficient. And the court also put in some language about how a lot of this training, you know, came out of a book. It was, you know, there's a curriculum book and the teachers were teaching out of this book, and they're like, it's just kind of rote, you know, just kind of teaching straight out of this book, and so it's not really that significant, that important. Well, that ended up causing two decisions out of the Ninth Circuit. One, the Our Lady case, which actually came second. The Beal case, the St. James case, came first in December 2019. And the Beckett Fund got involved at that point, and we filed a petition for en banc rehearing, asking the whole Ninth Circuit to reconsider the decision that had just come down. And while that petition was pending, another panel of the Ninth Circuit decided the Our Lady case, and they followed the decision from St. James, and they said, "Yep, this is right. You know, because you're not showing anything but function." And even though you did have and the court said that you had the plaintiff here had very significant religious functions, that's not enough. You've got to be able to show the other considerations as well. And so in summer of last year, the nine members of the Ninth Circuit said, that's wrong. You know, we would vote to grant rehearing, and we would, you know, explain why our panel decision here was wrong, but that wasn't enough to command the majority of the court. And so en banc rehearing was denied. And about a month later, the Seventh Circuit issued a decision in the Strelinsky case that said, yeah, this is desperately wrong. The fundamental touchstone here is function, and not, you know, what it is that people are doing for the religious ministries, and not these kind of formalistic considerations about title and tax status and training and things like that. And so then the cases went before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court granted cert, and the briefing finished up over the spring. Argument was actually scheduled for April 1st, interestingly enough. And then, of course, COVID hit, and we got bumped back until early May. And so oral argument was performed back on May 11th. And then we just got our decision today. And so that takes us to all the way up to the present. And so what the court was telling us today were a few different things. One, really, as I mentioned earlier, form follows function. The core consideration, the core ruling here is summed up in this paragraph, and says, what matters at bottom is what an employee does. And then the court goes on, it says, and implicit in our decision in Hosanna Tabor was a recognition that educating young people in their faith, inculcating its teachings, and training them to live their faith are the responsibilities that lie at the very core of the mission of a private religious school. And so while the court didn't go beyond that question, didn't answer, you know, other types of teachers and those types of situations, it says where you have a teacher who's responsible for educating and forming students in the faith, judicial intervention has to stop. That has to be the end of it, because any more interference ends up becoming an entanglement with religion. And it ends up, you know, having, you know, requiring judges to second guess religious judgments. And you end up with at its core, an interference with the, the religious beliefs of the organization. Because really, you know, part of what the kind of the core understanding, the kind of the thing that kind of drives what's going on with the ministerial exception is the idea that personnel is policy. And so allowing the government to get involved in the selection or termination of ministers ultimately means allowing the government to get involved in the expression and content of religious belief, which is a big, big no-no. And so the ministerial exception exists to preserve a church's independent authority in matters of preaching and teaching and expressing the faith and performing, you know, rituals of the faith. And so at the core of what the ministerial exception is trying to do is protecting the autonomy of the church to decide for itself what it is and how it gets to kind of express itself and conceptualize itself. And so that's what the court did today. And it went back and it looked carefully at the Ninth Circuit's basis for its holding and it said, listen, in the Hosanna-Tabor decision, we were really clear that we were not adopting a rigid test. And that's exactly what we said. We're not adopting a rigid test. And so you got it wrong when you came behind us and assumed that what we were doing was, in fact, adopting a four-factor test instead of four considerations, really treating them as four factors, and all those boxes need to be checked. The court said that was just fundamentally incorrect, and the court also said, you know, that the respondents here would have wanted to go further. They actually wanted to make it a four-factor test, and a four-factor test that started primarily with the three formalistic criteria. Like, you only considered this fundamental aspect of function, you know, what an employee does, what exactly is being performed for the religious group. You only get there after you look and see and confirm, yes, they have a religious title, yes, they have religious training, and yes, they have some sort of religious, you know, legal status, you know, like a tax status or something like that. And so unless you can show those things, you don't even get to the question of the kind of religious stuff that they're doing. And the court pointed out that raises a host of problems, not least among them that you then end up in a situation where you could have somebody who, you know, certain faith groups don't have formal religious titles for their ministers. They don't call their ministers ministers. And certain faith groups actually think that's theologically wrong. You know, there's a certain equality of all believers, for instance, in the Islamic faith. And so there's not this expectation that you're going to have, for instance, ordained clergy within those other faith groups, often minority faith groups. And so the ones that would be hurt by this test would often be the ones with whom the country and people in the judiciary and the government would be least familiar with and least comfortable with, minority faith groups. And in fact, interestingly, some of the, you know, there haven't been that many ministerial exception cases following the 2012 decision in Hosanna-Tabor, but several of them have been with minority faith groups, including three, for instance, with Jewish faith groups. And so these are the kinds of groups that are often most protected by the ministerial exception because they're the ones that the government would be and the courts would be least familiar with. And so protecting, drawing this broad circle around their ability to select their teachers and leaders is particularly useful for faith groups that would otherwise suffer disproportionately. So the court identified that problem with the respondents' theory of the case and how they were trying to press it. The court also rejected the respondents' argument that the teachers' argument that you had to show that someone was a co-religionist in order for them to be a minister, right? So the argument here was that to fit within the ministerial exception to be a voice of the faith, you had to be a member of the faith. And there's a certain kind of facial appeal to that, certain surface appeal to it. But the court pointed out that it's, you know, the devil's in the details, so to speak. And as soon as you start digging in, you see, well, how is a court supposed to decide whether or not someone is a member in good standing of a particular faith group? And why is a faith group limited in that way. I mean, if a faith group decides that they want to put their, you know, for instance, a seminary, for instance, wants to put its Old Testament teaching class in the hands of an Orthodox Jew who might have significant scholarly understanding of those, as long as they can, you know, ask that individual, you know, this Christian seminary, as long as they can ask that individual to teach in a way that's consistent with the faith, there's no reason from, you know, an expressive perspective why they couldn't ask that individual, you know, allow that individual to teach, you know, the Torah and other books of the common, you know, books of the Christian and Jewish Testament, Old Testament and Torah. So the court rejected that and saying, how are we as court supposed to determine whether or not, for instance, a Reformed Jew and an Orthodox Jew are sufficiently the same kind of Jew, or a, you know, Southern Baptist and an American Baptist? How is it a court is supposed to make those kind of determinations of what a co-religionist is? And there was also a related argument that, you know, maybe that one of the teachers here had been a Catholic, but she was no longer a Catholic, and so the ministerial exception shouldn't apply to her. And the court was kind of threw up its hands at that and said, well, how is a court supposed to determine what a good Catholic is? And really, I mean, why would we put that kind of burden on a religious group for them to have to, you know, go snooping behind their teachers and their leaders to ferret out whether or not they were, you know, sufficiently up to speed on the faith? And so the court rejected those arguments because of the kind of religious entanglement and interference that they would necessarily entail. So that's kind of the thrust of the holding. There was a concurrence by Justice Thomas again, and joined this time by Justice Gorsuch, and he reiterated his view. He joined the majority opinion in full, and reiterated his view that courts should be very careful not to second guess the sincere religious determinations of who was a minister. And then there was a dissent by Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg that basically said that, yeah, we agree that Hosanna Tabor was right, and yeah, we agree that, you know, if there had been a termination here over for a religious reason, that would probably be, that could be permissible, that could be within the ministerial exception, at least at a, you know, conceptual level. But here, these teachers weren't ministers because they didn't check the boxes. So the dissent largely followed the line of reasoning that the Ninth Circuit had. Two things I want to kind of tease out and emphasize for purposes of kind of, you know, what's important about today's ruling. You know, there were the ones that we talked about earlier, very important for all faith groups. The court went out of its way, spent several, you know, a couple pages talking about all the different faith groups that have, that are part of our nation's rich diversity of religious education and how they were all going to be protected under the decision. There, you know, the protection from government entanglement and things like that. But two things that are, I think, worth emphasizing. One is that it really does clarify the confusion that was existing somewhat in the lower courts about the role of a function in determining whether or not someone is a minister. And the court didn't say that function is the test. It didn't say if somebody has a religious function, that's the end of the test. They just said that function can be enough in an appropriate case. So the other considerations, such as title and training, would certainly be relevant and certainly something that courts could consider to further confirm an employee's ministerial status. There's nothing about today's decision says that can't happen any longer. But what it does say is, it's enough if there's someone is doing the kinds of very important religious things that these teachers were doing, teaching the faith to the next generation, entrusted with expressing and modeling and inculcating the faith in the next generation, then that was enough. And that would allow them, that was enough for the ministerial exception to apply. And, you know, even with the courts that had applied the ministerial exception, there had been some confusion on that point. The Sixth Circuit had said, hey, we found two considerations in our case. We're not sure if, you know, one consideration would be enough, but we think two is enough. And the Second Circuit did basically the same thing in a couple of cases that it had ruled on, where it said, yeah, we don't have all four. We don't think we need all four, but we're not quite sure. And so we'll go through and, like, analyze all four, you know, and do an analysis. Do they have the title? Do they have the training? Before, you know, coming to our conclusion. And so I think this is going to make the analysis a lot cleaner, and it's going to bring it a lot more neatly within the purpose of the ministerial exception, which is to protect the autonomy and the independence of religious group in identifying its identity and expressing its identity. So there's that clarification that took place. It's not any broader than Hosanna Tabor, because Hosanna Tabor never said the four considerations were necessary. It clarifies Hosanna Tabor and makes it very clear that where function is of a nature similar to this one, then that's enough. That being said, there's another move that the court made that was, I think, very important. It's going to be very helpful doctrinally in understanding these and other cases. And that is, the court put this with the ministerial exception within the larger constellation of the church autonomy doctrine. And that is the understanding that churches and religious groups, synagogues, mosques, and the other kinds of parachurch organizations, they have independence, fundamental independence in matters of faith and doctrine, and in matters that are closely linked to their internal government. All of those things, of course, are tied up in when it comes to the selection of ministers. And the court spent some time really kind of teasing this out and making sure it was clear that this isn't just kind of some standalone, you know, employment discrimination sort of doctrine, but rather a fundamental First Amendment recognition in the religion clauses that churches and other institutions have core autonomy in deciding matters of faith and doctrine without any government intrusion. And the court went so far as to say that state interference in that sphere of autonomy would obviously violate the free exercise of religion, and any attempt by the government to dictate or even influence such matters of faith and doctrine would constitute one of the central attributes of an establishment of religion. So again, both sides of the religion clauses working together, the free exercise clause and the establishment clause working together to protect this core sphere of independence for religious groups to establish their identity and to control, you know, how they express their faith to their members and to the next generation. So those are the two things that I think are really coming out of this decision. One, you have a clarification of what Hosanna Tabor did. So it's not broader than Hosanna Tabor, but in some ways it's deeper than it, because it drills it down and helps Hosanna Tabor identify and locate Hosanna Tabor within the church, broader church autonomy doctrine. So with that, I'd be happy to take some questions.
Perfect. Let's now go to audience questions. We'll now go to the first caller.
Yeah, I'd like to return to the argument before the court, to a colloquy between Justice Kagan and the attorney for Beckett. She asked about a math teacher who is told to embody religious values and infuse instruction with those values, whether that person would be eligible and covered by the exception. Attorney for Beckett said no. She said, well, what about a math teacher who is told to begin every class with a prayer and leads the class in a prayer? Attorney for Beckett said no. And she says, well, what if they're teaching 20 minutes of theology every day, but they're still a math teacher? Attorney for Beckett again said no, they're not covered by the exception. So apart from telegraphing to headmasters like myself never to retain Beckett if we're sued by our math teacher, I'm curious to know whether that view, a view, by the way, that finds purchase on page 15 of Sotomayor's very hostile dissent, whether that is the view of Beckett. And if it's not the view of Beckett, why is Beckett's attorney making that kind of argument in the court?
So thanks for the question. So the ministerial exception has been understood as protecting the ability of faith groups to express their faith and to ensure that the transmission of their faith is unhindered. And so the kind of heartland considerations that drive what the ministerial exception about isn't any employee of a religious organization, but rather those that are involved in the expression of religious faith. And so if you have an employee, say a math teacher, who really doesn't do very much of that, really does almost none, de minimis amounts of it, then in those cases, courts have never found of any courts since 1972 that those kind of individuals would be a minister. Now, there are other doctrines that come into play that are important to consider here, including doctrines that are available under, you know, just statutory ones, for instance, under Title VII that protect the rights of religious organizations to hire and fire for religious reasons. And so those kind of doctrines are there. There's also the freedom of expressive association, right? So this is the idea that even if somebody's not teaching your faith all the time, if they're an employee at your school, you know, and you have a religious school, and so maybe they're the coach, you know, on a team or something like that, or a math teacher, and they start espousing views that directly violate the faith of your school. Well, that's going to raise significant expressive problems, right? Because if you allow somebody to come, stay on staff who is in a leadership position, and they come in and say, hey, 2 + 2 = 4, and also Jesus is not the Son of God, right? That's going to be a problem for a Catholic school. And so while the ministerial exception probably wouldn't apply in those circumstances, the freedom of association would, and probably laws like Title VII, their religious discrimination or the religious exemptions would apply to protect a religious school's ability to make sure that their ability to express the faith remains unhindered. The key here is the ministerial exception is very strong medicine that protects these kind of, you know, at a very high level decisions that have to do with people who lead or express the faith in significant ways.
Thank you. Let's now go to the next caller.
Thanks for the presentation. As I understand all three cases and what you've just said today, it is framed in terms of the religious organization's right to select their own ministers, their own leaders. So that manifests itself in hiring and firing. But how does this doctrine relate to other employment decisions that are not as overt as hiring and firing, such as harassment, accommodation, pay rate, leaves, and so on? How would that fit in?
Great question. Thank you. Yeah, so today's decision only concerned the question of hiring and firing. That was the issue on the table, so to speak. Now the doctrinal implications and things like that are gonna carry farther than that. And the courts aren't quite as clear on how the ministerial exception applies outside that context. There have been some courts that have said that there's a little less discretion to religious groups on certain types of internal employment decisions that aren't hiring and firing. And then other courts have rejected that. They said, no, basically, if somebody is a minister for a religious organization, then all of the fundamental employment aspects of the relationship are going to be something that the religious group gets to control. So, you know, you don't have to work there, but if you choose to work there, then they're going to be able to tell you, for instance, where the ministry is going to take place. So if they're, you know, the Catholic Church says, you know, if you want to be a priest, you got to be able to be a priest in Peoria, right? Or something like that. And then they get to make those kind of internal decisions about the supervision of the employment. And you saw that actually in today's opinion, several times the court emphasized that not just, you know, the decision to select and the decision to terminate, but also the supervision of an employee is within the religious group's control. And that of course makes a large degree of sense, right? Because if the only power that a religious group has in ensuring that their ministers are accurately reflecting and preaching the faith is the power of termination, right? Or the power of the initial hire. And that really kind of hollows out their ability to ensure fidelity when it comes to issues of faith. If somebody starts preaching, you know, in a way that's inconsistent with the faith, and you put them in the religious groups in a very difficult position if what they have to do then is choose between kind of pastorally coming alongside this minister and helping them to get to a place that more accurately reflects the faith group. But, you know, then that could be viewed as harassment, right? So then, you know, the religious groups are left with the only tool in their toolkit really is the tool of termination. And a lot of groups, religious groups, don't want to do that. And of course, this would be exactly the kind of thing I think that, in a certain respect, that Justice Alito is getting at in the majority opinion, where he said the government can't, not only can't control those decisions, it can't even try to influence them when it comes to pushing the religious groups in a way that would prevent them from being able to kind of make those kind of internal pastoral decisions about, you know, working alongside a minister who needs some direction or guidance short of termination. So that issue isn't quite as clearly resolved in the lower courts, but a lot of the principles are established in cases like today.
Understood. Thank you.
Let's now go to the next caller.
Let me pursue what I think you were kind of on the edges of with the last questioner. And I guess it's two parts. One, let's assume religion does not enter into the decisional process with respect to hiring or firing. I assume even if one is a minister, that under Title VII, one can't hire or fire on the basis of race. And my second question is going to be sex after Bostock, but let's get to that in a second. But you can't hire or fire on the basis of race, age, blah, 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 in Title VII. And secondly, I assume we're going to see some very difficult decisions coming in the future where faith does dictate hiring, firing when it comes to sex, transgender, post-Bostic. So I'm kind of interested in, one, this isn't open season for discriminating on the basis of race, et cetera. And secondly, the tough cases are going to be the post-Bostic faith-based decisions not to hire or to fire.
Yeah, thanks. So I understood there kind of the two questions being, one, what about terminations or selection decisions that are made for non-religious reasons? And what about the ones that are made for religious reasons? The decision, actually, these cases were both cases where there wasn't an expressed religious reason for the termination. It wasn't like, hey, you're no longer praying the Hail Mary right. You're praying it in a way that's inconsistent with the faith. It was, you're not leading the classroom correctly. You're not teaching in a way that maintains order and discipline in the classroom. And so these cases address that kind of that first question. Yeah, a religious group can, when it comes to their ministers, they can make the termination decisions regardless of whether that termination decision or a selection decision is grounded in a specific religious rationale. And of course, that actually makes a lot of sense, because if we're talking about somebody who embodies the faith, who expresses the faith, then necessarily they're inability to maintain order in the classroom, while, some might see that as kind of a secular criteria, reflects poorly on the religious ministry. And if they can't, if they can't maintain order in the classroom, regardless of whether they're saying the Hail Mary right, they're still not going to be inculcating the faith in the way the school wants. And so, courts have been pretty uniform on that going back for decades, recognizing that it's not required that a religious group have an expressed religious rationale for termination. And this is good, right? And it's good that religious groups have a lot of flexibility here, because that protects religious diversity, that robust religious diversity the court was talking about, because different faith groups have different criteria and different considerations that are looking at when it comes to who's going to best embody the faith. And so you have, you have some faith groups right now that are intentionally hiring from only minority faith backgrounds, or primarily from minority faith backgrounds, but minority race backgrounds. And that could raise racial discrimination concerns if they're expressly saying, well, only hire somebody from this particular race or this particular ethnicity. That faith group can legitimately be saying, well, we want to minister in this context, and so we're going to, this is a criteria that as a faith we want to pursue. And you know, as a from secular perspective, that could be very problematic, but that's not something that courts get to interfere with. They can't come in and tell a religious group to stop making those kind of determinations when it comes to their ministers. And then all nine members of the court today, to the second side of that question, all nine members of the court today agreed that when a termination or selection decision is made pursuant to a religious purpose, you know, you really are saying the Hail Mary wrong, then yeah, definitely the ministerial exception is going to apply there. So you got both sides of the protection that are reflected in longstanding First Amendment case law, again, going back to 1972. Thanks for the question.
Daniel, is there anything anything else you want to focus on before we conclude this afternoon?
No, I think we've had a really good discussion and appreciate the opportunity.
Perfect. Well, it doesn't look like we have any more callers, so on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speaker for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.